I played the Scooby-Doo theme song for you. You knew it was coming, so I thought I'd do it on my second inaugural podcast. I'd like to thank you all for downloading this second edition or issue. It's almost, I'm stuck in comic books almost. We'll call it an issue. That's actually the 1969 version of the original song from the first two seasons of the show. And actually, I think I prefer the Billy Ray Cyrus version of the song that was used on Scooby-Doo and the Witch's Ghost, which actually I will play at some time. I think he did the best rendition of it. The worst rendition was for Scooby-Doo and the Alien Invaders, which Jennifer Love Hewitt did, and I did not like hers at all. I think she was completely wrong. Matthew Sweet, who was an alternative rocker, he did a great version of the Scooby-Doo theme song. And I think probably one of my favorite versions of the Scooby-Doo song is probably from Simple Plan, who's kind of like a Green Day Blink 182 kind of style band, and they did the main theme song for the Scooby-Doo, or What's New Scooby-Doo cartoon series, which is a really punchy, upbeat, kind of a punk rock version of the song. That's probably my favorite version of the song after Billy Ray, just because it really moves and it has kind of a current style to it. It's hard to believe that Scooby started September 1st, 1969. This is the 40th anniversary for Scooby, and here I am. November 21st will mark my 10th year working on the character. I work on a certain amount of work for Scooby per year. 99, I started in November 99. I did some stuff, licensing stuff for Scooby-Doo and the Alien Invaders at the time. And then I moved into 2000. That's all I did with Scooby-Doo all year long. And after that, throughout all the years, I've kind of worked on a whole bunch of different Scooby stuff, a little bit per year. It hasn't been completely full year stuff, but it's been maybe, I don't know, at least two-thirds, maybe a half to two-thirds of the year sometimes is Scooby, mixed in with Ed, Edd n Eddy and Mickey Mouse and Winnie the Pooh and all the other licenses. Last year was primarily all Power Ranger material, which is great. And actually, because I've actually worked on Power Rangers Jungle Fury, which actually I lucked out on. That was actually, I think, really the best designed show out of all the 16 years that the show was on. I think that's actually my favorite. Just to give you a little bit of background on my work, in 99, early 2000, I was still kind of doing stuff by hand, and I was working with a designer who was doing stuff with me for Scooby, and she was after me constantly saying, you have to learn the digital part, you have to learn the digital part. And she said, once you go digital, you'll never go back, trust me. I went back to a community college. I took a couple classes. I took the Photoshop class, the Adobe Illustrator class, and a Quark class at the time. And I took these programs, and I did exceedingly well, and I was kind of living off Scooby money, because 2001 happened, and a lot of stuff fell through the ground after September 11th, 2001. And I was back in school at the time, and I was able to pretty much live off Scooby money, because I made a ton of dough in 2000 just drawing Scooby, and I just banked it all. And so I was living partially off of that and selling some stuff on eBay, so I could go back to school, stay pretty much the whole day in school, and then come home at night and spend like another 3-4 hours working in the programs and trying to get as good as I could, as fast as I could, because your skills have to be at a certain point, really. And I was trying to get them up as quickly as I could, because as I said in the last podcast, art takes time, and I think I learned more on some of my final projects in my Photoshop class, just spending 10, 12 hours that one day on a Saturday trying to finish up this book cover that I had to do, and it was still fairly new to me, the program. And I remember, I think I created a whole new language of cursing that day. It was the most frustrating 12 hours, but I think I learned so much in those 12 hours by just sticking with it and staying with the program and making sure I learned it all. Adobe Illustrator was the same way. It's like apples and oranges compared to Photoshop. And that was a struggle because when I was working on Strawberry Shortcake in 2005, or it was 2004, 2005, I can't remember. That was right after some stuff on Bratz. Yeah, so it must have been after that. So I did Strawberry Shortcake in Adobe Illustrator, and it had to be all vector art. The absolute hardest artwork I've ever done was Strawberry Shortcake. Completely, because it was all in Adobe Illustrator, and I was kind of learning as I went because I didn't really know the program that well. I knew it, but not enough to actually go in and actually be able to create artwork spontaneously in the computer. Like some people can just whip through the program and they just have it down to a system. They know keyboard shortcuts and they just know what to hit and they can burn out a gig really quickly. I was certainly not at that point, and it was a struggle. There were some really long days and some long nights too, which I'll get into it another time with talking about some Strawberry Shortcake. It's funny looking back on it now, but it's probably one of the best things that I had done at the time because it pushed me into the art. And actually, it made me sit down and really focus and learn the actual part of that computer software. One of the things about artists that I've come across is that a lot of them like to stay within one realm of art, where they don't want to bridge out and move into other areas. There's plenty of areas that they can go within and have a really great time drawing different things. But a lot of guys I know, some of them are just stuck in comic books, some of them are stuck in animation, some of them are stuck in children's illustration or just design work, and they just don't have the wherewithal or the drive to go out and seek other stuff. In essence, what happens when that well goes dry? What happens when you're not getting the calls to do work? What happens if you have a style that is no longer in vogue? Do you have a plan B that will keep money coming into the house? A lot of guys, they do their art and they're happy doing it. My idea was always to be able to do art and to be able to make a living at it. So whatever it took to do that, I was going to do it. There are some who would never have drawn Strawberry Shortcake. They would never have touched Bratz. They would never have drawn Power Rangers Jungle Fury. Maybe if they had a daughter or something, maybe they would have drawn that. But basically, they wouldn't have done those licenses. Some of them just like to draw superheroes. Some of them just like to draw specific things that they find interesting and they don't want to go outside that world. My whole thing was when I look at art, I had to justify it to myself. How am I going to live? If I want to draw this kind of art, and there's other competition out there, there's only so many jobs to go around. So basically, I had to distill in my mind down to the basic essence of what I found really intriguing about art. The thing that I really like most went back to graphic design in a sense that it's problem solving. What I like, and it applies to everything that I do, whether it's Scooby-Doo, Bratz, Winnie the Pooh, and upcoming soon stuff for Shrek 4, it's all problem solving. The same thing with graphic design, and that's why my plan B was always graphic design. If something fell through on the illustration front, I was more than capable of having a great solid portfolio in terms of going out and getting other work in design, whether it be brochures, business cards, book publishing, what have you, magazine layout, newspaper layout. I always had a solid background and a separate portfolio for all that material that I could go back and show to people. And that was the biggest boom to me, that I wanted to keep all my options open. And I enjoyed all that kind of work. And that's what I distilled it down to, was that I enjoy the thought process of problem solving. And what I mean by that is, if I have a certain area to work within, whether it's an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, whether it's an 11 by 17 size image, I have to work within the live area. Now, the live area is the maybe if we're working 8.5 by 11, there's a half inch border all around. Everything inside of that is considered the live area. The art cannot extend past that live area. So now you're given a scenario. in which you have to tell a given situation that you're supposed to draw, and you have to make it work. And it's the same theory as graphic design. You have to make it attractive, you have to make it readable, you have to convey a certain amount of information within that image and live area, and make it pleasing to the eye on top of that. Not to mention, if you're working on licensed properties, then you have to keep it on model as well, which is, par for the course, really. I mean, that's one of the essential things they probably hung up on more. And that was ultimately the thought process. It's almost like when you look at like movie posters, some of the great Drew Struzan movie posters that he's done for Star Wars, Indiana Jones. If you look at a lot of those movie posters that he did, a lot of the artwork that and portraits that he used were typical 8x10 portraits that you could get from any movie house or movie memorabilia place. They're the same stills. What made Drew Struzan great was his color theory and his layout ability. He knew how to lay out an intriguing image, which had all these different elements going on to it, and it would tell a story. It would thematically tell you, just by looking at an image, what kind of movie you were going to be seeing. And that was the brilliance of Drew. But basically, he had the same elements that you could get from every other place, but he was able to convey it in such a unique way that it had his stamp all over it. I guess most artists have kind of an ingrained sense of design skills. A lot of artists, young people, don't have that sense yet because they're not looking at stuff or they don't study it. Maybe they're looking at it, but they're not really seeing it or observing what they're looking at. There's a certain balance, and I think growing up reading comic books my whole life, pretty much, and reading, being into old movies, you subconsciously pick that stuff up and you retain it in your head. You know when a good shot is a good shot, especially when movies are in widescreen now. I downloaded a bootleg version of Little Darlings from 1980, and it's a fantastic movie, basically because I always had a thing for Christy McNichol, so that was a given. But the other reason, primarily, once I saw the movie and really kind of saw it from a point of view, it's a brilliantly directed movie. It was directed with such an economy of shots. It was, I guess, the director really had to get in and burn the movie out, but he told it so simply with as little camera moves as possible, and it was these beautiful sweeping pans. It's a great film to study in how to simplify your storytelling when it's just simple dramatic purpose. It's not a Michael Bay movie where every shot's moving, you got 20 cuts every second that you have to somehow visually digest. It was very simply told. Another great movie that I've always loved was Charlie Chan with Warner Olin in 1936, I believe, and it was called Castle in the Desert. And this movie was one of my favorite black and white movies. It's a great film to watch because it's very textbook in terms of storytelling. The shots and the way, because they used to have those big cameras back then, you have to remember. So it wasn't anything like today's lightweight, Steadicams, they can run around and get all of these neat shots. Back then, they had huge dollies that they had to put in tracks and trying to maintain these huge cameras and heavy lighting to maintain and get a good shot. And it was very hard to pick that stuff up, so they had to, limit themselves storytelling wise. And I think that's good for beginning people to really get that sense of design, learn how these old directors really set up a shot. The same as watching old TV shows. If you watch Gunsmoke, Have Gun Will Travel, the old TV shows, when they were put on a small TV, the quality of these TV screens were so bad that they had to do a lot of forced contrast. And what I mean by that, especially if the character like Have Gun Will Travel, you have a character like Paladin, who's the main hero of the show, he's dressed in black. So you would frame his character, he's all dressed kind of in black when he appeared. It was actually dark blue, his suit, when you actually saw it in person. But when you watch the actual show, it appears as black on a black and white TV show. And with that, you get a sense of how the director had to frame these dark contrasts with the whitest whites of the exterior of rocks and the desert he's traveling through with his horse. This is for a simple screen. We weren't working in widescreen at that time, so we had to get a certain amount of shots in a full screen shot, and you had to really know how to frame your work. And some of those old shows, especially Gunsmoke, because the stories were so good, they used an economy of dialogue. It just told you exactly what you needed to hear. It didn't have any extraneous exposition that just went all over the place like a lot of big summer movies, especially one of the worst ones is Transformers this year, which just was all over the place. It just, if you have a simple story, there's a simple way to tell a story. You don't need to be all over the place. And I guess maybe that's why the pacing of a lot of movies is considered slow now. If you look at Star Wars, still the best Star Wars episode four. If you look at that, it looks like a documentary film. It's really the pacing on it is extremely kind of slow, but you enjoy the world that you're in. The same as the biggest blockbuster in 1981, Raiders of the Lost Ark. You look at that first Indiana Jones movie, and it was told in such a brilliant way. But if you compare it to other movies of today, they did a lot of medium shots. They pulled back. I mean, Spielberg was at the height of his game right then. He came out of that, and then he went into E.T., of course. But Raiders of the Lost Ark is still my favorite Spielberg film. It's really good to go in and study these old directors, especially their earlier work. Guys, now, I would never recommend studying a Michael Bay movie because there's constant movement. He's very much more flesh than substance. And really, you'll find that in a lot of artists' work as well who work in comics or animation. A lot of guys are just flash and no substance. I mean, if you get really into the art, there's not a lot of construction, volume, and shape that's being used in a lot of your current artwork a lot of times. There are a tremendous amount of really great artists too, but you really have to look at the art and be able to break it down with basic objects. And a lot of problems, a lot of guys don't have that sense of volume. They have shape and they have form, but a lot of them don't have volume in order to try to convey a sense of weight. That's one of the hardest things about CGI with movies currently. The problem from hearing Chris Bailey, who was a friend of mine who worked on Alvin and the Chipmunks, and he's working on Alvin and the Chipmunks 2, the Squeakquel, as they call it. He's always said the hardest part to get these computer CGI designers to do is to be able to convey a sense of weight and volume in it. CGI always looks like it's slightly hovering somehow on the ground. It's not really there. There's a sense of weight that is always kind of missing on that. That's really hard to get down. Even in a movie like Speed Racer, which I loved, the sense of the cars bouncing all over. There was some of the driving through the canyons and stuff when it's going full speed. Because they're all CGI, there's a sense that they were missing some of that weight that they needed on those cars to convey that it was real. You can always tell a real effect from a CGI effect. I don't care how well it's done, even with the matting and stuff. I mean, that's why I really appreciate early Jackie Chan movies, especially like Jackie Chan's Who Am I, Operation Condor, Armor of the Gods. You watch those movies, and Jackie was doing stuff for real that no stuntman in the U.S. would ever attempt to do. And that was just the incredible thing. That's why I love watching those Jackie movies, because he just was able to convey that feeling of realness to it, because it was real. There was no CGI. Even Raiders of the Lost Ark, going back to that, Harrison Ford had to do a lot of his own stunts because he knew if it was a stuntman, they had to pull back. The audience would know it wasn't him, and it takes out some of the lore. You want to see your heroes put into those situations. And that's why I always say studying the old movies is really kind of a better thing than studying a lot of the newer stuff. Especially movies like Casablanca. What a great film that is. To Kill a Mockingbird has some tremendous shots in it. There's a great documentary I'm going to recommend to you, which is on DVD. It's called Visions of Light, and it's like the art of cinematography, and it's a bunch of cinematographers talking about their favorite shots they've ever done in movies and how they actually were able to do certain effects. Most people look at Citizen Kane and they go, "Is this really the best movie ever made?" He did break the mold. He did break the storytelling narrative by jumbling up, and you can see where Quentin Tarantino took that and did the same thing in Pulp Fiction, where you break the narrative. You're not going from A to B to C to D in terms of a story point. But where Orson Welles was absolutely genius in, he was not a filmmaker. He came from a theater background. And he was able to convey dramatic effects that you could only do in theater that he had no idea how to do in terms of making film, but he applied those elements of the theater that he was when he was working on Broadway and brought them into film, and they were absolutely astounding how he would draw your attention when he would frame a shot. The opening shot with the dark house up on the hill, and there's this little yellow window with the light peeking through. Your eye automatically goes to that window. There's a certain amount of shots that you really have to appreciate. And I recommend if you get Citizen Kane, you get the deluxe version of it, and it has the commentary. Roger Ebert, there's two great commentaries on it, but the Roger Ebert commentary for the film is really good. It is a slow movie, but you have to appreciate the storytelling with the cameras and what he was able to do. Greg Toland, who was the cinematographer for that film, was way by far one of the best cinematographers ever. And it makes me kind of lament the fact that Orson Welles had tried to get the rights to do The Shadow, which he had played the part of Lamont Cranston on the radio. He wanted to team up with Greg Toland. He tried to get the rights to do The Shadow as a film, and how absolutely brilliant The Shadow would have been in his hands if he had given the rights. The problem with Orson Welles that he had burned a lot of bridges in Hollywood after The Magnificent Ambersons and Citizen Kane combined, pretty much. And they took The Magnificent Ambersons away from him at the end, and gave it to, I think it was Robert Wise to finish up and get it out there, because there were too many problems with Orson, because they gave him complete control, which was, unheard of at that time, really, that he would get that kind of control. But what and this all goes back to just being observant to everything around you, all different kinds of media. And I always think everything really has been done before. There's nothing new under the sun. And I think if you like certain artists of today, you can basically look at their work and try to distill where they got stuff from. And you can usually hike it back to like three or four other artists. It's like, if you look at Bruce Springsteen, we'll say. If you look at Bruce Springsteen, he basically comes from a Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan comes from like Woody Guthrie. So you can track it back and see who these guys who or who their influences were. Steven Spielberg has said he's ripped off the opening shots from John Ford's Stagecoach. He's blatantly said, they were his favorite movies, and they were the ones he always kind of stole stuff from, because he grew up watching that stuff. There's more people in Hollywood who grew up loving the Adam West Batman TV series because they got so much out of that. That made them want to get into film and actually pick up directing and doing all kinds of entertainment work. So basically, what I'm trying to explain is just basically keeping your eyes and ears open and basically going back and seeing a lot of the older stuff. It's just because it's old doesn't mean it's not fun, doesn't mean it's not hip. In terms of graphic design, like I said, that was my plan B. Now, I'm self-taught. For a little backstory, I was in high school. My freshman year of high school and my second year, I took mechanical drawing. And that was basically pre-CAD in those days, where you had to design houses and architecture. And I think that's where I got the bug for working on a minute scale in terms of drawings, fine-tuning my skill with the pencil, learning how to keep things clean in terms of the art, learning how to letter, learning how to read a ruler. And then from that point in building a house that you would design on paper and then building it with actual balsa wood and other material afterwards to build your own dream house. In 11th and 12th grade of high school, I had taken graphic design, and basically I had found my I guess my rainbow of sorts, where a lot of people don't know where they're going to go. They follow through life. I think I found my well of inspiration for some reason. I took to it. I took to graphic design like a fish to water. I don't know why. For something, it just clicked in my mind, and I can't explain how or why. It's something just clicked and it worked. There was something about the problem solving. You were given specific little parts of an ad, whether it's the text and the picture, and they were all on different sheets of paper, and it were you on one sheet of paper, and you had all these different elements all over, and you had to cut them out and paste them up into a well-balanced ad. It's problem solving, and that's what I enjoyed, and that was my main thing. I excelled in that class. I had a teacher who pushed me, Robert Preston, who pushed me to do the best I could. I never got less than an A plus in the class. I know it became a game. I couldn't allow myself to get an A minus. It became a game in a sense with myself that I had to push myself, because I just enjoyed it. And actually, I kind of rather have been in the graphic design class than in math. I've still never used calculus yet since I've left, but I can still read a ruler. I decided if I had to write my own characters and be able to plan my own stories out, I had to take writing classes. And I decided to go into writing, and I wound up taking some creative writing classes at the local community college again on the side. And I would write short stories. I get good responses back from the teacher on it. And I kind of went out and sought other work, and I would start writing articles and stuff for local publications, building up a tear sheet. Or a tear sheet's when you write an article or a story that gets printed in a magazine, and then you buy the magazine and then rip it out or tear it, and you put that in your portfolio. It's a tear sheet. And I submitted stories to a local publication called Dining Entertainment Magazine, and they would give me a bunch of freelance stories. I do a lot of restaurant reviews, where I would get to be able to eat for free and then go home and write about the experience at night. And I DVD reviews, wedding review, I mean, all kinds of different articles on home improvement. I mean, stuff I would probably never have considered. Once again, much like my art, how many people would have done drawn strawberry shortcake or brats? It's the same thing with writing. How many people? If you're a writer, you should be able to write anything that I give you. You shouldn't say, "Oh, I just like to write DVD reviews," and that's it, because then you're limited. You're of no use to me. And if I'm a corporation who's hiring people, you have to be of a use to me. If all you do is pencil, let's say comic books, for instance. If I work in the field of comic books and all I do is pencil, you severely limited your amount of work that you're ever going to be getting. If you can pencil, letter, ink, and color the whole show and write, you can do your own comic. You can do everything across the board. Especially, and you're a lot more useful to an editor. If something happens and you're able to ink your own work, your inker gets sick or something because you're penciling the book, your inker gets sick. That happens. You can then pick up the inking pen and go off and ink your own stuff. He'll trust you to do that because he knows you can do it. The same thing with lettering. If they need an emergency lettering job, it's done. When I do comic books for overseas, when I was doing Scooby-Doo for the foreign markets for the comic stuff, I had to do the whole show. I had to pencil, ink, letter, and color. So I had to do the whole show. It wasn't like when I do stuff for DC Comics where I just pencil and I ink my stuff. If I do the covers, yeah, they let me pencil, ink, and color. But basically, I have to do the whole show for everything, whether it's children's books or licensing art. There is no assembly line of people working on stuff. You have to do everything yourself. In terms of like having the plan B, as I said, I had my plan B was always kind of graphic design. And in the early 2000s, I had a subscription to Mac Design Magazine. Now that was a magazine that was primarily for, Photoshop, and it would give you tutorials, stuff like that. They were talking about new products coming out for the programs and such. And I had gotten a subscription for it for a couple years, and I finally had canceled it, basically because every issue I would turn to the letter columns, and it was constantly a Mac versus PC battle. I've had PCs, I've had Macs. I like a PC more because I think you can basically do a lot more with it. I think there's more software available for it. I think there's more, even little podcasting programs like I'm using now. I can get that if, it's a bigger deal if you got to go look for it for a Mac. There's not as much available for Mac as there are. That's why there aren't as many viruses. There aren't any viruses for Mac because only 3% of the population actually have Macs. Most artistic people do use Macintosh computers. The platforms for these programs are exactly the same, meaning you can work on a Mac or PC. If it's just a piece of art and you're just coloring on it, they'll open up on a Mac or PC and everything will be fine. The only problem we have ever really come across is the problem with fonts. There is a difference between PC fonts and Mac fonts and transferring them over. If you do a layout in a on a Mac program as opposed to a PC program, yes, you will find differences with them not opening right, or you're not importing them right. There are problems with that. But if you're just doing artwork like I do, I've never had issues with that. A lot of times, if you know that's what the art's going to be, you just flatten the layers. But I've never had any real issues with any jobs like that. This article was actually taken from Mac Design Magazine, and it was in the I guess the editorial section. It was written by Scott Kelby, who was the editor-in-chief of the actual publication. And he had written this piece as a letter to, I guess, potential people who were coming out of school who wanted to build a design portfolio or get actual work working in the industry. And I read this thing, and this actually appeared when I was taking classes at the community college. And I ripped that in the magazine, and I remember printing out, because I thought this was useful to the other students in the class. And so I saved it all this time, and I'm going to read it to you because this is really out of date. This is like 2001 when this was actually written, but it's a great article. The title of it was "Do You Have the Right Stuff? How to Make It in the Design Business" by Scott Kelby. Because Mac Design is a design magazine, we often get questions in an email that most other magazines probably don't get. For example, what's the name of that font you guys used on page 78? Or what's the black color build you used on page 62? However, because we're not only read by professional designers, but also by aspiring designers, we get a steady flow of questions like, how do I break into the design business? Or what's it take to work for a magazine? Quite often we're asked, I think I have some design talent. Should I go to design school? I thought I'd tackle the should I go to design school question first. That way, people who've graduated from design school won't have to wait until the end of the article to write me a nasty gram. They can get a jump on it right away. See, I care. Okay, here we go. Should I go to design school? My answer, only if you need to. What I mean is that you have a feeling that you'd be good at design, and you really like creating things with your computer, but you don't think that you can go out there, set up shop, and compete against quote-unquote real designers for paying clients. Essentially, you need to learn how to design. You need an in-depth understanding of color, contrast, depth, typography, tension, spatial relationships, and dozens of other concepts that, I hate to say it, some people are lucky enough to be born with. Besides, if you felt like you could go out and kill the competition, you'd be looking at leasing office space. I'll go ahead and field the common follow-up question. But I don't need a design degree to get a job? Absolutely not. We hire graphic designers on a fairly regular basis for Mac Design Magazine and our parent company, and in the ads we run, we never mention design school as a requirement. The two requirements we do list are, first, if we're hiring someone to work in print, the candidate must be an expert in Quark Express, Illustrator, and Photoshop, plain and simple. If we're hiring a web designer, the candidates have to be an expert in Dreamweaver or GoLive and Photoshop. Second, they absolutely must have real-world experience. Their portfolio must have work they've created for paying clients. When students show up with a portfolio of hypothetical projects they've created in design school, we can't use them, and they don't have practical work skills. There's a third requirement, and that we don't mention in our ads as well. Sheer speed and the ability to meet constant crunch deadlines. We don't have 2 weeks to design an ad. We have 2 hours. Our deadlines aren't at the end of the semester. They're at 7:30 p.m. today at the FedEx Dropbox. Part two of it is real-world experience. So even if candidates graduate at the top of their class and the hypothetical projects in their portfolios look great, I can't use them. I need them to work somewhere else for a year or two. Ideally in an ad agency or publication with constant tight deadlines and demanding clients so that they can build up the real-world experience on somebody else's dime. Technically, you shouldn't have to train a designer who's just graduated from design school, but the reality is that you often do. I don't have the luxury of that time. I need a designer who can go to work today. When we hired Ted LoCascio for our graphics team, on the first day he was laying out 230-page workbooks. He kicked butt. 5 minutes of instruction and he was off and running. The next time I heard from Ted, just a day or so later, he had sets of proofs ready. Why is Ted so fast, so intuitive, so just plain good? Ted has lots of real-world experience. How did he get the job in the first place? He was an expert in Quark Express, Illustrator, and Photoshop. And he had a portfolio filled with real-world work jobs that he created. Did Ted go to design school? Honestly, and this is the truth, I have no idea. I'm not even going to ask him until this article is in print. I'm not alone in this way of thinking. The first time I was aware of how important the real-world knowledge is was when I read an article a few years back in Print Magazine where they asked art directors what the most important criteria were for hiring a designer. Their number one criteria? Candidates had to know Quark Express, Illustrator, and Photoshop. Why? Because if they know those applications, they can put those people to work. This is part three. Not all schools are good. I do feel that a good design school makes a great designer better and gives novice designers the skills they need to compete. But unfortunately, not all design schools are good design schools. About 3 years ago, I taught a Photoshop seminar in Pittsburgh. During the web section, I used Adobe PageMill, the most popular Macintosh web app at the time, to assemble my Photoshop-created graphics into a web page. It was the last class of the day, and right after it was over, a woman came up to me and burst into tears. She told me through the flood of tears that she was from Israel and that her family had sent her to a design school here in America to learn to build web pages. She was just a month or so from graduating from a two-year web design course, which she had been taking so that she could go back to Israel and design websites for her family's business. For 2 years, she'd been learning to hand-code sites with HTML, and when she saw what PageMill can do, I basically built the homepage in class in about 10 minutes, complete with links to other pages, outside pages, image maps, email links, the standard stuff. She was just crying. Why hadn't she been told about PageMill? Her family had gone through significant hardship to send her abroad for 2 years of schooling, and she had made many personal sacrifices. What she had just seen on screen was exactly what she needed to do. She was overcome with anxiety. I tried to comfort her and let her know that her HTML skills would still come in handy, even though I knew that I would never hire her, but I would have hired somebody who was an expert at PageMill back then. Needless to say, this was an individual case, but her design school wasn't teaching what would, within 12 months, become the standard for web page design, layout apps rather than hand coding. Also, think about her 2 years at school. In today's tech-driven market, years are counted in dog years. 2 years stuck in school equals 7 years of tech changes. Look back 2 years ago. Where was Flash? Underground. Where is it now? Everywhere. Where was Adobe Live Motion? There was no Adobe Live Motion. All of that being said, let's revisit my first question and response. Should you go to design school? Only if you need to. However, if you're going to attend design school, make darn sure that your part-time job to pay rent and tuition isn't delivering for Pizza Hut. Make sure you snag an internship, or ideally, an apprentice position at a local design firm or an ad agency. That way, when you do graduate, you'll be an expert in Quark Express, Illustrator, and Photoshop, and you will have real-world samples in your portfolio that will help you get the job that you want. Now, everything that Scott Kelby just talked about in that article, I can absolutely 100% agree with, and that's why I wanted to read it to you, because it applies not just to graphic design, but to art. The art that I do is in the same exact way. If my portfolio is good, it'll get me work anywhere. I never went to art school. The only schools I went to really was community college, and that was just to learn the digital end of it. But if my portfolio was not up to par, I would not have gotten to work, and I would not be a working artist all these years later. So that's one of the main things about having a strong portfolio and a well-rounded portfolio, which I'm going to get into as well at another podcast. So basically, with this podcast, basically what I want you to consider is finding your interest level. If you had told me 10 years ago I'd be drawing Scooby-Doo and all these other cartoon characters that I grew up on, I probably would have laughed at you because I never would have seen my life going this particular direction. I just rode the wave, and this is where it took me. It was all fun. I'd never regretted any of it because I enjoyed the ride and the creative process. That was what's gotten me through all these years and will get me through probably to the end of my life because I enjoy the process of problem solving. But basically, you have to have the drive and the determination to do what you want. But you have to have a strong portfolio. And you have to get real working experience. And that's the hard part. Sometimes you'll find yourself in a catch-22 when it comes to getting work. And then after that, now you have to work on your speed and your devotion to meeting deadlines, which is another whole area which I'll touch on later. But I just want to touch on stuff that would hopefully inspire you to try to find out what makes it click in your mind and what actually floats your boat creatively. Don't go all over the place and say you're interested in everything. Find out exactly what your actual true interest is in art and where your actual love of stuff happens to be. If you love comic books, then by all means, you should pursue it. Just remember that there's a lot of competition out there, and your work has to stand out amongst everyone. If you want to go into animation, there's plenty of animation jobs in feature films right now. You have to know the business end of it. TV animation right now is really dormant right now. There's not a lot being produced, and you're going to be competing against guys who have been working in animation for many, many years, and they can't get work right now. So you have to take that into consideration as well. What is it about the art that you're creating really gets you jazzed about getting up every day and doing it? You have to distill it down into the basic interest level and why you find it interesting. Okay, I'm going to wrap up this podcast now. I'm going to thank you all for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed it and gotten stuff out of it. As always, if you have questions, you can email me or hit me up and let me know if you have anything you'd like answered. And if you're a Flintstones fan, here's Pebbles and Bam Bam singing, "Open up your heart and let the sun shine in."
Mommy told me so.
Yeah, it doesn't get more upbeat than that, now does it? See you next week.